session number 16808, Reel 31.
Right, Spittle's Reel 31.
Yes, he said, what you've got to do, he said, is get somebody to run you down to the officers' club in Brussels. He said, and there's an officer down there. He said, they know you're coming, so he said, I'll put you right when you get there, you see. So I said to Fred, you're going to run me down, Fred? He said, yeah, come on in. So we hops in the utility lot and nips down the town. And I goes in, and this chap at the desk, I said, come down about an officer. I said, I'm come from Avenue de Frey. Oh, yes, he said, I've got an officer upstairs. He said, Lieutenant Wolf. So I said, oh. I said, he said, well, let me know you're here, you say. So he gets on the thing lot, and I suppose they got a thing in the room, telephone lot, you say, and he came down, you say, and good looking bloke, he was like a film star, he was, for looks, you know, got a little Mickey, and he was a Jew. He was born in Berlin, I found out, actually, but he was a naturalised Englishman. And from travelling with him from then to when I was demobbed, I got the impression that he was married. He's got a nice family in London, and his business was to do with cases and paper. And I've often thought, we used to have a firm here at Northampton, Giessen and Wolfe, who were big paper people, and I've often thought that he must have been probably involved in that, because he was obviously come from the right background, although he was a German by birth. And he wasn't, to me, a nice person. We didn't get on as well as we ought to have done had he been what I call a nice person. And as we were saying, he was German by birth and very arrogant. Not arrogant in the manner of a German officer would be, but in his manner of approach, more what in English speaking we would say he was direct. Very direct. And he was always ready to step back as far as I was concerned, because he had not been a man who had been in service in like an active action situation, and he was only here because he could speak six languages, well educated and fluent German, and he was a German, and this job had cropped up and it suited him down to the ground. But because I was an ex-tank man, having seen action and long service, he was always ready to give way to me, as you imagine Germans give way to what they feel a superior person in some respect or other. But so we got on grudgingly, and so he came down, and as I say, we had a chat, and I said, so what's the form? He said, well, I've got a car around the garage, he said, if you'd like to go and collect it. He said, take it back up to Avenue de Frey, he said, and get it serviced, he said, because we're going up to Germany in it, you see. So I said, oh, right. Well, I'd never done this before, like Fred Ashton had done, driver Batman. And sometimes he'd gone up to Germany and only been away a couple of days right back, you see, just to take an officer up. And so I said, very good, sir, I'll do that. So I took this Opel Olympia up to the garage, and it was going to be two or three days for it, because he was on leave, you see. And so I got it serviced up and done, and this staff sergeant who was in charge of the garage, Tate his name was, and he came from the Remy, and he was a wizard with motorbikes. And I've always told people, you sometimes get a motorbike that, to put it bluntly, it's a bastard, it won't start. But as soon as Tate went up to it and put his hands on it, it dare not refuse. You could have a bloke there, I mean, some of them blokes there were mechanics, motorbike mechanics, and they get one and it wouldn't play ball at all. And I say, staff, got one. He'd say, right. I say, he used to come over, he'd put his hand on the handlebars, lift the valve on the pedal, in with the valve, straight away. It was magic. Anyway, he was in charge of the garage, and one of the jobs we used to do, obviously, as these motorboats and utilities were given away, they had to be replaced, you see. So periodically we would have to go out to one of these units where we would collect new utilities, you see. Perhaps not brand new, but they were reserviced ones, or, you know, but they were back on the road, you see. And we would go out and take a truck, because we got a 1508 truck, and we'd go out in a truck and take, so however many, it'd perhaps be, say, four to collect. So I'd take four drivers, because I was in charge of someone for them, you see, and I used to just go as the NCO in charge of the party, you see. So I'd take four drivers, and we'd go to this location, see these four vehicles, and I'd check them over to make sure they was all right, you see. They'd had a time for them, and then we'd drive back in a convoy, you see, to Brussels. And we had a very funny incident this time, because one of the blokes who was there was an Irish lad, and he was a typical Irishman. Good-humoured, he wouldn't fall out with anybody, old Paddy. Big, raw-boned Irishman. If you sort of say, well, if I'm going to get in a scrap, I'll want him with me. But he was good-natured as anybody. He'd never fall out with anybody, old Paddy wouldn't. And I don't ever remember him getting drunk while we was there in Brussels. He used to like a drink. But he was what everybody seems to have the impression that Irishmen are naturally thick. You know, they're good-natured and all that, but there's something about an Irishman, they all say, well, of course, they're always a bit thick. And Paddy was no different, you see. A point that raised that point to accentuate what happened. And we go to this place to collect these utilities. And on the way back, Paddy's breaks down, you see, can't say it. So I said, well, I told the others, oh, well, you carry on. And I said, oh, well, tow Paddy, you see. So we got a rope, put him on a tow rope, you see. And I'm in the one that's towing, and he's behind in the one that's just being pulled along. And we hadn't gone long, and Paddy's papping the Uto and flashing the lights, and we stopped. And I said, what's up, Paddy? Oh, he says, if you don't mind, Corporal, he said, oh, he'd like along a rope, he said, you're a bit too close. I'm a bit worried. Oh, that's all right, I said. Well, so I think we went to somebody's house or something and borrowed a rope, the promise to take it back. And anyway, we got a... and extended the length of this tow rope, you see. Actually, much too long, but Paddy was concerned about being too close. And they were on there with one of these cobbled roads in Belgium, and they have a very high crown on these cobbled roads. They're very steep, the crowns are, you see. And we're going along there, and we're going down this road, and they used to have little tram lines from one village to another in those days. At the side of the road, there'd be some trees all the way along the road, then the other side of the trees was this single tram track. And they used to be like trams, you see, and they used to run, say, like 10 miles from one village to another, you see. And that was one of these. We was in that sort of situation, but on the right was a row of quite like bungalow types of houses, with gardens in front. And we're driving down this road, and down the road is this horse and cart with just a double wheel, you see, just two wheels. So it was quite short in length. The length of the horse and the cart it was pulling was quite short in length, you see, from back to front. Much shorter than the length of the rope between our car and Paddy's car, you see. And by now, Paddy, as you do, you drift into a sense of, well, compatibility, you know. He's being pulled, all he's got to do is sit down and steer the car, you see. Perhaps touch the brake occasionally. And we're going down this cobbled road, and it was quite narrow. It's in the country, you see. And coming up towards us is one of these, what I call American 15 underweights, which are quite large for a British 15 underweight, because they're very sort of flamboyant by comparison, big mud guards and all that, you see. And he's coming up facing us, you see. Well, I'm thinking, the distance he was, that we're all right, because we're driving on the right-hand side of the road, being in Belgium, you see. And we passes this horse and cart, and this vehicle's coming up towards us. And it's still not reached us, you see. And I'm anticipating the length of the tow rope and Paddy's car. I've got to get that past and all. So in the distance, this chap who was driving, he said, what, do you want me to get by? I said, yeah, I said, plenty of time. I said, the speed, the relationship of the spades they were doing and we was doing in the horse and cart. So he passes it, you see, this horse and cart. And Paddy don't, you see. Suddenly, there's a hell of a bloody bang. The rope don't break. And everything stops, and there's dead silence for a minute. And I think, what the bloody hell's happened? And as I turns round, I said, this horse's head is in the back of our van. And it's dead. It had broke its neck. The horse's head, it's amazing how big an horse's head is when it's in the back of a little van. And this horse's head there, it's a big eye sticking out of its head. The shafts of the car are down each side, sort of thing. And Paddy's in the back of the cart. I thought, Christ. Well, this yank, he just stops. He said, are you okay, bud? And I said, yeah, okay. And he drives off, you see. Well, the bloke who was with the cart, he was walking at the side of the horse on the inside between the horse's head and the curb, you see, fortunately. He's standing there, totally bewildered, wondering what the bloody hell has happened. And there's his horse with his head in the back of our van with its neck broke. There's the cart with nothing in it as it happened. And Paddy, he's got his bonnet stuck in the back of the cart. Of course, that was totally ruined, that, you see. His van was a write-off. The horse was dead. So I get saying, oh, Christ, what are you going to do with this? So, of course, there's the farmer. When it all dawns on him, he starts getting excited. And a woman came out of one of these houses up to the path, and she could speak English. She said, I saw what happened. She said, what a shame. And again, the horse was, I mean, if it hadn't been dead, I reckon it had kicked us to death, you know, in its frenzy, but it wasn't. It just broke its neck. And she'd done the arbitrating between us and the farmer, or whoever he was, the chap with the horse and cart. So we gets all that sorted out, you see, about his claim for compensation. I'm going to have to make a report when I get back and everything like that. We gets all the details sorted, you see. And then it comes back to Paddy. And, of course, we had to leave the car. The car was a write-off. We couldn't drive it any further, so we just had to, I don't know where we put that. We put it in this woman's garden or what, but we had to leave it. And I said to Paddy afterwards, I said, there's going to be an inquiry about this, Paddy. I said, so what are you going to tell them? Sure, he said, it was my fault. I said, I know that. I said, but, well, what happened? What was you thinking of? He said, sure, he said, it's rather funny, you know, he said. Because, he said, we've been going quite such a long time, he said, and I was just there in the car, quite happy, like. He said, and I have to be honest, he said, I forgot I was on a rope. He said, and when I saw that Yankee truck coming up the road, he said, I thought, I'd better let him go by. So I pulled in behind the cart. He said, and you know what happened? And that's what he did. He just totally, wrote himself apart from being towed, and he saw this lorry and thought, I'll let him go by. And he just casually and deliberately pulled him behind the cart. And that was the result. He always broke his neck, wrote the van off. And I'll never forget it, old Paddy. And when we got back, we just filled in an accident report. So there was no court of inquiry, nothing like that, because it wasn't a unit, you see. It was a ragtag mob of people. So all we did, we filled a report in, and I suppose the farmer was compensated, I don't know. But that was just one of the incidents that happened when we used to go and fetch these things, you see. And another thing that used to happen, I mean, we're digressing here very greatly, but another thing that used to happen, these lads on the motorbikes, when we used to send them off, we used to impress on them. Don't drive too far. Stop, get off, have a rest. I said, yes, all right, and all, you know. But we used to get the odd one who, for whatever reason, I mean, people do it now on the motorways, you know, when they run into the back of a stationary vehicle because they mesmerise themselves into going to sleep or hypnotise themselves simply by the drone of the vehicle and the mesmerisation of going on and on and on. And that's what used to happen. They'd be on this motorbike sitting there quite happily, and suddenly they just either hit something or just roll over on the floor, go in a ditch or something, because they'd mesmerised themselves and gone into a coma. And so one of our jobs used to be to fetch the bikes back, you see, because the bloke was probably in hospital. And on one occasion we went to fetch one back, and it's where I met one of my old yeomanry mates. And he was with us in Normandy, and he was a tank commander actually, and we went to fetch this bike back, and it was a usual thing. It was a Red Caps post, and they used to finish up some barn or other somewhere, and then I'd probably have a bell tent on the corner of the road. And anyway, we went to fetch this thing, and this old Tatey, he went with me, or I went with him, one of the two. And we get there, and he goes in, you see, to do the desk work, like the paperwork. And I can hear this voice, you see, and I thought, sounds a familiar voice. So while Tatey's in there, I wandering round, looking about, you see, because we took one of the utilities, you see, to catch it. And I looked in, and it was a chap named Roy Breeze. And I've got, he's on a photo with the yeomanry and training and that. And he was bum up here, he never got wounded. They had to fetch him out, his nerve went out, you see. He was a tank commander. And so he went in that, and I thought, well, you know, we shan't never see him again, like. And it was old Roy, and he was a sergeant in the military police. And so we had a bit of an old natter, like, you know, and it was nice to see somebody who you never thought you'd ever see again, like, you know. And just one of the little incidents that happened when we went to fetch one of these bikes back. But these are the sort of things that happened while we were in the Avenue de Frey. And anyway, where did we get to now, was it?
You were working for Lieutenant Wolfe.
That's right. And so these are the things that used to happen. And I got the car ready, this Opel Olympia, you see. And then on the blower, they said, Reg, you got to fetch that officer down the club. I said, oh, right. I said, no, you ain't got to fetch him here. They said, you got to pack all your kit up, take all your kit, and go down the club and pick him up, you see. So I said, well, what's happening? So they said, well, he's got to go up to Germany. So I said, what did take all my kit for? So I said, I don't know. They said, that's the message. They phoned up, take all your kit, take it in the car, and pick Lieutenant Wolfe up down the club. So, all right, so I packs all my gear up, saves all my Cheerios and everything, to the twins and all that, and drives down to the officers' club, you see, and goes in to the desk. I said, Lieutenant Wolfe. Right, he said, so he lets him know I'm there. And next thing is, the chap says, he said, he wants you to go up and help him with his kit, you see. I thought, well, that's fair enough. So I goes upstairs, you see. He goes in, he said, right, he said, there's this and that, and he's speaking with this German air of authority, you see. He's not asking. He said, there's that and that and that, and this and the other. So if you do that, and you do that, and do that, you see. So my hackles are coming up straight away, and I said, yes, right. And immediately the scene is set, you see. I don't say sir, I say right. I picks up some of the kit, I get to the door, and I said, oh, you'll manage the rest, and I walks out, you see. So I goes down, puts the kit down there, puts it in the car, and goes back to the desk, you see. This chap says, a phone goes or something, the chap says, your lieutenant, he wants you back upstairs. He got the rest of his kit. I said, I told him, I said, what kit's up there, he can carry that is, you know, it wasn't more than one man could carry, you see. So I said, tell him, it's all right, he can manage that on his own, you see. So whatever he said, I don't know, but the outcome of it was Lieutenant Wolfe comes round with the rest of his kit. He doesn't comment on it, but he obviously doesn't like it. So I put all the kit in, you see, and he goes back inside to, for whatever person reasons, and this big Canadian officer turns up, a major he was. He says, excuse me, Corporal, he said, where are you off to? I said, well, we're eventually going to a play called Esselheide in Germany. I said, but I've got to go round to the Red Caps, I said, and get a route, you see, because what you used to do, if you travelled about in on Europe, with all the roads in shambles as they were, although the road signs were still up, they were not all serviceable, you see, so you couldn't always rely on signposts to take you to where you wanted to go. So you always used to go to the PRO, the Public Relations Officer, who was the military police in Brussels, you see. And so I'm going to go to Esselheide, can you give me a route? And they'd like the AA would give you a route, you see. stopping places, and if you're going to need petrol, where you could get it on the way up, you see. All things like that, you see. So I goes round to there, and I'd done all that, you know. So I'd got to go round to there, you see. So I said, I'm going up to Esselheide. He said, Esselheide, what part of Germany is that? I said, well, I've got no idea. I've got to go round to Redcap, so I say, get a route. Well, I've got to go to so-and-so, he said. He did say where it was. He said, there any chance of a lift? So I said, well, I don't know. I said, depends where it is and where we got to go, like you say. So, anyway, Wolfie comes out, you see, and he says, totally ignores him, you see, because you don't know him. Straight into me, he said, right, he says, now, have you got that route? I said, not yet. So I said, I've got to go around and get it. So he said, oh, right. I said, before we go, so I said, there's this gentleman here. I said, he wants to know if we could give him a lift. No, he said, no chance, he said. See, so, this Canadian, I thought, he's going to pick him up with one hand and thump him in a minute, you know. I could tell the impression this Canadian, this one, he was so abrupt, like, you know. I thought, I could sense this Canadian, you know, and he was a big one and all. So I said, well, this Esselheide, I said, we're not going to do it in today. We shan't get there today, you know. So he said, well, we don't know how far it is. I said, well, if it's up in Germany, it's too far anyway, whichever way we go, I said. I mean, I'd been up and down to Germany a few times, you see, to different places. And I knew what the roads were like and what your timetable was likely to be. And so as far as I was concerned, it didn't matter where it was. The distance from Brussels to the German border, wherever this Esselheide was, we weren't going to do it in a day, you see. So I said, well, we shan't do it in a day in any case, wherever it is in Germany. I said, so if this officer's unit is not too far off air track, I said, we can stop there for the night. So he said, possibility, Lord. So this Canadian said, if you stay at my unit, he said, you'll have everything you want for your night's comfort, he said. If you want a bath, you can have a bath, he said. You can have just whatever you like. He said, that's my unit. So Wolfie immediately, his cunning move, mind comes in and thinks, ah, I've got something to gain here. Right, he said, you get in. He said, we'll go around the pile, we'll sort it out there. So this Canadian, big Canadian, piles in the back. He sort of thing. But he didn't mind because he was going to get a lift. And we goes round, you see, and we gets the route out. And it so happened, it wasn't far off the route, you see. It wasn't going to put us about much. So we goes to his unit for the night. And I hadn't realised it, but they had lumberjack units in the Canadian Army, which obviously, similar to our Remy or Pioneer Corps, you see, and they were a lumberjack unit. So we gets there, you see, and to this place that night, and Wolf is highly delighted, he's going to be a guest of honour, you see, this major. Now you get out, he said, you come right away, and Massey said, you are going to have some hell of a feed, and Wolfie was guest of honour, so he was lapping it up, you see. Totally ignores me, which is what he always did, you see. I don't exist, you see. I belong to the car, you see. So next thing I see, Wolfie's away, and that's it, you see. I'm left to look out of myself, which was all right, because the lads there, the Canadians, like, you know. And so anyway, we spends the night there, you see, and the next day, old Wolfie wasn't too keen to start too early, you know. You know, he's having the time of his life, being made a fuss of a night, you see. And this unit wasn't going anywhere, they weren't in action, like, you see. And so I won't get talking to this sergeant, this Canadian sergeant. And he's looking around the car, like, you know, he says, some hell of a car you got there, you know. And I said, yes, it's one they found in the garage, like, you know. And of course, before we left Brussels, I told Wolfie, I said, you can't take it like that, you see, because it was a car, you see. So we painted up the garage, we painted it and camouflaged it, you see, put some paint on it, put some camouflage on it, British style, which wasn't very effective. And then we put some numbers and that on it, you see, to make it look official, because if you had a car with no marks on, people looked at it suspiciously. So if you see the photo sometime, you'll see it's got some a shield on it with some numbers on and a cross, you know, like a shield with a cross on. And when you go out and drive around, you see, people think, oh, it's official, you see, because you've got numbers and things on it, you see. If it hasn't got any, they're suspicious. And so I got it all dolled up, you see, so it looked like an official car. So this Canadian, he was looking at it, he said, about the tyres, you see. I said, yeah, so that's going to be my problem when we get. I said, I've got to find out where we get some tyres, I said, because these are what was on when he took it, and it stood, I suppose, during the, they hadn't done much running during the war, so they were getting a bit worn out, you see, perished and whatnot. So he looked at this Canadian, and he said, get your spare wheel out, he said, I reckon Jeep tyres would fit that. So I said, oh, so we get the spare wheel out, you see, and his mate ripped the tyre and the tube off, you see, and puts a Jeep tyre on it, fitted perfectly, you see, except it was like a balloon to a silly one, you see. But we weren't thinking of that at the start, you see. Just, I said, Christ, yeah, smashing. He said, okay, so then the British Army couldn't have done this, could they? But Canadians or Americans, they just because it gets me a set of Jeep tyres.
Why can't the British Army do it?
Well, it wouldn't be right, wouldn't they? Wouldn't think of that, would they? You got to sign a book, you had to sign for them and all things like that. And there's somebody you got to ask. But in the Canadian or the American Army, they just go up and say, I want this, you know, and about say, oh yeah, shit, you know, and okay, guy, you know, and that's it. And nobody bothers, because it's stores, isn't it? So, I'm kitted out with five brand new Jeep tyres, you see. And eventually we're going to go. We loaded up. Unfortunately, I had to do a bit of a turn. Immediately I was going to start, you see. So, as I start to turn a wheel, I only get about just over a half a lock on. And the tyre's jammed again, what do you call it, you see? The frame. And I can't get a full lock on. So I stopped, you see, and these Canadians are all standing there watching, like saying, cheerio again, all that, you see. And I stopped, and he kind of said, what's up, you know, and I said, I can't get a full lock on. He said, oh, God, you know. He said, just a minute, he said, this Canadian, this sergeant. He goes off, he comes right with about an 8-pound hammer, you know, on a short handle. So he says, put your lock rod over, you see. So, of course, Wolfie's got out, wondering what's happening. I put the wheel rod over, so the wheel's out, I say. And he looked, and he can see the mark, what I made with his tie, you see. He gets out, bang, bang, bang. Oh, Wolfie, what's going on, you see? And he knocks a bloody great dent in the frame. He said, try that, you see. Well, he tried it, and I said, that's locked, that ain't quite right. He said, okay. Bang, bang. Bashed a bloody great dent in this frame so we can get a full lock on, you see. So we have to do the same the other side. Oh, Wolf is having kittens. He's visualising the car collapsing, you know. And of course, it's only a little car, and it's bang, bang, you know. And he belts a dirty great big dent the other side. So, and on the photo, you'll see it, if I get around to showing you it, these Jeep tyres, like their balloon tyres, inside the money cards. And that was perfect, like, you know, after that, it was all right, you see. And of course, when I got demobbed, when I left Wolford, they were still on, like, you know. But anyway, so we fix this up, we've full set of Jeep tyres, you see, and off we goes up to Germany. And we gets there to this place, and we gets there at night. And it is a displaced persons thing now for German troops who are being rehabilitated and sent home. It had been a prisoner of war camp, obviously, you see. But now it was full of Germans. They were in the cage, in the barbed wire and everything, although they were not prisoners, only in the sense that the accommodation was inside the camp, you see, still with the barbed wire around. And outside the camp was the living quarters where the personnel on site, they lived there. The Germans lived in the cage, and everybody else lived outside, you see. And so that was the only difference from being a prisoner of war camp. And they got this thing going, so we gets there, you see, and it was at night time, in the dark, and we drives in, goes to the guard room, right, you see, and we could hear the music going, and of course there's lights on, you see, and hear the music going, and Wolfie goes in, and he comes out, and he said, Right, he said, I'll tell you where they go. He said, they'll tell me which hut we can use. So we drove up the camp, he said, to this hut. And some of these huts, they've been used for offices, I suppose, because when you went in the door, there was a corridor straight up, and all rooms, individual rooms, you see, all the way up the other side of the centre corridor. And we goes along, and all got numbers on, you see, and we goes along, and he opens it, oh, this is it, he said, and there's a bed and everything you need, like a bed sitter, you see. Room about as big as this, I suppose. And he said, right, he said, we get all my kit in here, he said. So we go there, you see.